From Melman Consulting, this is 14th and G, the podcast at the intersection of business, politics, and culture, coming to you from the heart of Washington, D.C.
Well, I'm really excited to welcome Patrick McGee, who is author of the New York Times bestseller, Apple in China, of which the great Ben Thompson of Stratechery fame said, and I'm going to quote him here, "This is the best book about Apple ever written, one of the best books about China ever written, and one of the best books about tech, period." And he knows all of those things better than almost anybody else. So that's pretty cool. Congratulations and welcome, Patrick.
Thank you. Yeah, he certainly knows those topics better than I do. So that was a pretty surreal quote when he
it's almost drop the mic and be done right there. For all of our guests who join us, as always, we got 150 copies this time because of the interest and the demand. And after this, we'll send around a link for everybody to enter your mailing address, and the first 150 will get a copy sent to them. But let's start at the beginning here, Patrick. You covered Apple for the Financial Times for years. What about your coverage? Like, when did you realize, hey, there's a book here? There's something that, you know, a really well-covered company that people don't actually know that I think is worth telling.
So I would say pretty late in the process. I did not ably cover Apple for 4 years for the Financial Times. I ineptly covered it for the first 3 years. And then I finally sort of broke through and got interested in how they actually manufacture their devices. Apple's a really difficult company to cover, in part because they make it so. It's not that their PR people are inept. It's that they are deliberately unhelpful, right? They are unhelpful by design. They don't want you to tell good stories about Apple. And that can make things difficult for you. So Apple's marketing prowess is such that I think journalists sort of, in general, tend to fall in line by covering Apple as the company wants to be covered. I mean, in a kind of unconscious way. I mean that we cover their product launches and we cover their product features rather than the sort of sensitive underbelly of the company. And so I was more interested in covering Apple from almost like an interdisciplinary perspective. And the book came out of the realization that Apple doesn't just manufacture in China because it's convenient, the cost is low, and there's an abundant labor force. I think that's what I assumed, and I think that's what basically everybody assumes. And so, well, what's the story? They send their blueprints over to China, and a bunch of factories send them back. You know, it sounds like a sort of boring story. It sounds like a total non-story. The reality is quite different. And so I can describe this in different ways, and some are complex and some are simple, but let's just give the most simple way, which is that there's a unit within Apple called Manufacturing Design, and their mission, in a sense, is to take the brilliant designs, whatever has come out of the brain of Johnny Ive and the ID team at Apple, and they have to figure out how do we actually conjure this thing into reality. So they need to find suppliers who, of course, in the early 2000s begin to be more and more in Asia and more recently are basically in China. And they need to find suppliers that have some degree of competence and capacity to sort of take on the mission. And so what ends up happening is that engineers, you know, dozens, hundreds, thousands, depending on sort of what perspective you're taking here, from Apple, go to these factories and they train the hell out of them. They basically teach them how to run the production processes. And especially of interest in the early 2000s is they're often working with factories that not only do they not have the tech competence to respond to Apple's demands, they also don't have the wherewithal to buy the machinery that Apple needs. A sort of star example is that when Apple builds, or maybe I should say when Steve Jobs and Johnny Ive come up with the idea of the unibody MacBook, which is making a MacBook where you're not welding the parts together, you're using a CNC machine, the way, like, you know, Michelangelo finds an angel within, like, the whatever marble material he's looking for, you sort of are finding a laptop within, right? So you're extruding the material rather than adding, not using additive manufacturing, you're not welding it together, you're extruding it. And so they're doing this with these CNC machines that cost, I don't know what Apple pays, but if you look on the web, you'll see these things upwards of $1 million each. And Apple ends up buying 10,000 of them in a single year and still needs more. I mean, the company that makes them called Fanuc, Apple literally signs a contract to buy as many as they are able to make, right? More than 10,000 a year for multiple years. And then it scours the globes for others. So My point is that in this, the earliest years of the iPhone, I mean, this is for the MacBook, but just to sort of put ourselves in the temporal reality here, this is the late 2000s. The Chinese factories don't have $1 million to buy 10,000 machines. Today they do, to be clear. Back then they didn't. And so Apple doesn't just sort of train up workforces in these factories. It buys the machinery so that they can go not just beyond their perceived manufacturing abilities, but their actual manufacturing capabilities. And so then you get into the story of realizing that there's a geopolitical tale here, that Apple isn't just ordering things from China. It's sending engineers to build the competencies within China to fulfill those orders. And you just think, well, that's fascinating. Where do I learn more about that? And you realize nobody's ever written it before. There's not a single article about manufacturing design engineers. Even the title manufacturing design engineers is not really used, except from companies that hire a bunch of people from Apple and they try to do the same thing. So to title it Tesla, for instance. So in the late summer of 2022, that's when I started talking to people from MD, realizing there was an incredible tale to be told, and that it wouldn't just be a corporate history, it would be a geopolitical one, because as the numbers came in, as the significance came in, I realized that it was just as true that Apple had built China, that China had built Apple. Sorry for the long-winded answer, but that was the
It's fascinating, and you covered a lot of ground, a lot of things that I hope to get into in a little bit more detail. But
sure.
But I guess after podcast number 10,000, you get really good at offering the concise thumbnail of the whole thing. Let's take a step back, because a lot of this is the story, and something that I didn't appreciate is that rather than, you know, you tend to think of Tim Cook as this supply chain genius, and like early on they decided we're going to globalize this thing. And what you find is Apple is probably the most reluctant outsourcer in all of tech. They wanted to make it in the United States. They'd like to make it in their backyard if they could. What caused a company that wanted to keep everything in-house, that wanted to keep, you know, jobs, wanted it all made in the United States? That's what was great about the Next computer. What led them ultimately to become so deep in China when that's not where they started?
Yeah, so this is where I was really excited to tell this early history of Apple. I mean, if someone was writing the book Apple in China, it is not at all intuitive that you begin in 1996. That's where I decide to begin. And the reason I start there, this is before Steve Jobs has even come back, is that Apple is literally days away from bankruptcy. They're days away from being able to meet payroll. I believe they have 14,000 workers at the time, a whole bunch of debts coming due, basically no product to sell, and everybody's buying Windows 95. I mean, this is just after Wall Street was expecting them to have this blowout quarter because Apple had projected unit sales at a really high clip, and they end up having the best revenue they've ever had, and yet they lose money. And it's because they had cut prices of their computers so much that they were losing money on every sale, a sort of incredible thing. So, of course, total mismanagement at the top. And it leads to the CEO being fired, Gil Emilio coming in and then trying to do what he can for 500 days while he ends up hiring Steve Jobs and acquiring Next. But what had happened in 1996 that had been reported on, but nobody really understood the significance of it, is that they sell their plant in Colorado. So Apple was building Macs in a facility in Fountain, Colorado. But in order to be able to make payroll that week, they sell it for $200 million. And once they've sold it, they realize they really can't make their own products anymore, certainly not in Colorado. And they need to begin orchestrating it. So for the first time in Apple's history, they adopt a global outsourcing strategy. And then Steve Jobs comes in the next year, and he's not all that happy about it, but it's necessity. The company has no money. There's nothing that they can really do on their own. They don't have the balance sheet. They don't have the talent. They don't have the labor. And so it's really that they come up with the translucent iMac, right? People remember the first one being Bondi Blue. And the question is like, well, who will build this for it? And Steve Jobs sort of famously loved Japan and really wanted to do it in Japan. But Japan was pretty high cost by the late 1990s. And LG in South Korea was the provider of their monitors, sort of basic, bulky, beige monitors. But nevertheless, they understood the innards, if you will, the CRT technology. And so Apple basically decides that the next computer is going to essentially be a monitor with a computer stuffed inside, and that Johnny Ive is going to redesign it and make it look all sexy. But LG is just the partner. I mean, as far as I know, LG is not even a contract assembler at the time, right? But Apple turns them into a contract assembler because they can do the monitor. And this story just hadn't been told, where why they went to South Korea, and then what happens when that computer becomes the best-selling computer in America is that Apple wants to globalize it, and so they need more production, and so they can't just rely on LG in Korea. So LG expands to Wales and Mexico, and that's such a brilliant strategy, except that it's not executed well at all. The Mexico factory literally is on fire, and the Wales production line, literally known as the toaster line, because of the propensity of, I think, the circuit boards to catch fire as well. So twin fires, basically like a metaphor for how things have gone so poorly. And this is when Terry Guo, who has a relationship with Tim Cook, newly hired as a senior vice president of operations, basically calls him up and says, "Let me fix this, like, give me a chance." And this maybe doesn't sound significant now, because you're like, "Well, yeah, Foxconn, yeah, they must have had a great reputation, da 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 da." They had a terrible reputation. Nobody wanted to work with Foxconn back then. I mean, they're called Foxconn because they build connectors. They're into really low value stuff. They don't have expensive engineers, but they just have this hunger and this ambition. And Tim Cook and Terry Guo already knew each other because Tim Cook had just been hired from Compaq, the world's largest PC company at the time. And Compaq was Foxconn's biggest client. And so I think, there's some like mystical reason as to why Tim Cook leaves the world's like sort of king of the clones to go with Apple, a company that's, been on the brink of bankruptcy and is not gracing the cover of magazine covers like the end of an American icon, the fall of an American icon, that sort of thing. And so it's weird that Tim Cook goes there at all. And I'm speculating, I think Terry Guo sort of catches the significance that if this like person who I would describe as like competence incarnate is going to Apple, there must be a reason. What is that reason? And there's something about it that gets Terry Guo intrigued. And so again, I'm giving you another long-winded answer here, so I apologize. I hope it's interesting. But basically, like, the thing that needs to be understood is that Apple was a manufacturer at the time. And for them to give that up, especially for Steve Jobs to give that up, you couldn't really understate the importance. They were never going to be a company that just sent over blueprints to someone in Asia and said, "Let us know when you've built it." And so they sort of need to build the best of both worlds, which is that they retain the manufacturing, they retain the control, but they get all the balance sheet, impact of having somebody else do it, right? Of adopting manufacturing as a service. But because they're coming up with all these designs that nobody knows how to build, and I want to be clear about that. This is not a knock against Taiwan or China or Asia writ large to say they didn't know how to build it. Nobody knew how to build a translucent iMac. And I try to go into some interesting details about what plastic injection molding is and what they were doing to make it so tough. I mean, Apple's own product design team couldn't make it, right? If anyone knows the book, the chapter about this is called Unmanufacturable. And it's because what Johnny Ive has come up with, the engineers are just quitting en masse because nobody can do what Johnny's asking them to do. And indeed, nobody's ever able to ever do it. So they have to change the design. And Johnny Ive is sort of humbled because what he's asked for just can't be done from an almost physics-based perspective. I don't quite say that because, who knows what you could do eventually. But anyway, I'm giving a long-winded answer. But the point is that manufacturing is in the DNA of Apple, and they only give it up if they can basically retain that DNA, retain that control. And the answer to that is, we're going to fly people out to whatever factory we need to, and we're going to sort of understand and cover every inch of those factories to maintain that control. And so they are late to China, they are late to outsourcing, but in the same way that they're late to smartphones or that they're late to MP3 players, Apple just does a better job than anybody else when they decide to get into something.
Well, so let's pull on that thread just a little bit more, because they're not the first people in Asia. They're not the first people working with working with contract manufacturers. You describe, and you make the point, I think it's a good point. It's not a knock on any foreign labor or foreign. Nobody knew how to make this stuff. So how did Apple and Foxconn figure it out? And then you talk about, rather than simply seeking lower cost, Apple was also looking for unconstrained design potential. And so I think the answer to that is what that means. But talk about how did they figure out how to build something that nobody in the world, no matter what their background, had yet figured out how to build?
So there's a couple answers to that. One of them is just that Terry Guo understands something that nobody else understands in the late 90s. And arguably, the Chinese suppliers don't really understand it until 2016. We can come back to why that specific year in a little bit, which is that there's almost no profit in working with Apple. They negotiate the hell out of things. And Apple's a really low volume player at the time. And so basically to other contract manufacturers, Apple is considered an irritant. Like, why would you want to work with these with this company that has these overbearing engineers who are in and out of your factory asking for all sorts of things, never taking imperfections, you know, having no tolerance for defects and so forth. And basically that's just seen as a challenge. And Terry Guo thinks of it as an opportunity, which is to say that he understands that having these engineers being in your factory all the time means that he's training your workforce. So the value of working with Apple is never the profit, it's the learning. There's a great quote that I don't use in the book, so I'll use it here, which is that a manufacturing design engineer told me there was a sense within Apple that working for Apple was a reward, not a business, right? And so if you understand what that quote means, what the person's saying is like the tech transfer is the profit, right? Or the substitute for profit. And so Terry just understands that and will move heaven and earth, not only to respond to Apple's demands, but to anticipate those demands so that when Apple realizes, oh, we need another production line, like Foxconn would already have built it. There's all these hilarious anecdotes where Apple engineers realize something, realize they need to make a move, and that Foxconn has already done it for them. And the reason why is because if they don't sort of have it up and running, maybe Apple has reasons to think, you know, we're a little overexposed to Foxconn. Why don't we go to Pegatron? Why don't we go to Wistron? Why don't we go to Quanta? And so Foxconn has this take it all mentality, and they're able to sort of take on more and more orders of Apple in sort of extraordinary ways. But the meeting of Apple and Foxconn is fascinating because Foxconn's desire to vertically integrate and make the client in a sense dependent on you really meets its match with Apple, because Apple has leverage and negotiators and strategy. So if you just look at a chart, let's say, of the Apple Foxconn relationship, if you look at either profits or profit margins, Apple profit margins and profits soar to the stratosphere between 2000 when they really start working together, and 2012 when Xi Jinping comes into office, and this is the sort of thing he's doing, noticing this, while Foxconn's collapse. Foxconn actually makes more money in absolute dollars and in margins in the early years of the 2000s. But they go from double-digit margins, more than 10%, to about 2% over that period. And there's something fascinating about that. And that subject, I mean, this is like a paragraph for me, but that should be a book on its own, the Foxconn-Apple marriage, possibly a biography of Terry Guo, possibly just the history of Foxconn. There's so much here that I'm trying to compact into a dense narrative, which is why it's sort of an easy read, right? It's fast-paced. You're always going through continents and time. But I sort of want more academic rigor going into these topics, because I know that as authoritative as the book is, it's scratching the surface on a whole host of things. I've given one answer there, but remind me more of what you were trying to get me to say.
So first, you're given a couple answers, which is great. And I was wondering, one of the things I was going to ask at the end is whether you were thinking about writing a book about Foxconn or Terry Guo, because he sounds like very much of a visionary. To your point, understanding that the learning is the payment. Yeah. And it also, one gets the impression that by design, he would take people who, once they got trained up by Apple engineers, he'd rotate them somewhere else within Foxconn. Yes. And bring on new people to be trained up. Is that indeed what Foxconn did? And was Apple not wise to that?
Yeah, no, I quote Tony Fadell saying this, that they would show up one day and find that they don't know any of the engineers. And so they'd say, hey, where'd our engineers go? And Terry had basically rotated them to like the Dell project or whatever, where they had taken all the skills that Apple had taught them for the previous 4 months, 5 months, 6 months. And they put them on projects that are actually lucrative. And it was like a new semester had started at Apple University. So were they wise to that? I mean, well, yeah, they noticed it, but I don't know. Foxconn didn't have zero leverage. They had some leverage. So, you know, It was just get on with the day and we'll train more people. But this is where, I mean, just to sort of get way ahead of myself, the number of people that Apple has trained is just wild, right? So this is their own document that they put out every year. And the latest figure is 28 million people trained since 2008, right? So I point out that's larger than the labor force of California. When I first cited the number 2 years before the book was published, it was 23 million, which I said was larger than the population of Taiwan. So in those 2 years, it's gone up by 5 million, which gives you a sense of how much churn there is in the Apple factories. In other words, people don't sort of get a job assembling iPhones and 6 years later, they're still there. I mean, to be clear, there's some of that. I want to be clear. There are people at Foxconn that have been there since the earliest days of Foxconn building stuff for Apple in 2006 for the iPhone. But, you know, I'll just give a number because it can be staggering. I've got some internal documents that talk about the problem of churn. And the example given is that this is about 10 years ago. There's a Pegatron facility, okay? So a Taiwanese rival to Foxconn in Pudong district of Shanghai. And the standing state of people assembling Apple products is 100,000. So I don't know that we have any factories in America that have 100,000. This is totally par for the course for China. The significance is not the number of people. It's that they're losing 25,000 people a month, which means they are having to hire 25,000 people a month. So the average duration of people in the factory was 65 days. So the churn rate was more than 5% a week. Like, when people ask, why can't America compete? That's why America can't compete. We don't have a single factory that I'm aware of with 100,000 people inside. And even if we do, we're not losing 25,000 and hiring another 25,000 a month. And that was just one factory. But that's happening all the time. And if you think the churn rate is lower, then explain to me why they've trained another 5 million people in the previous 2 years.
Although, why does a higher churn rate make for a stronger country and stronger manufacturing base?
Well, to be clear, it's both a problem and an advantage. It's a problem because obviously you would prefer that that people stay. But it's an advantage in that what Apple often relies on is what in China is called the floating labor force. And so there are 350 million people in China that have a rural household registration called a hoku, who live in the urban areas. So the people that go from the Western hinterlands and go live in Shenzhen, they don't have access to the welfare benefits in Shenzhen. They can't raise their children there because they can't go to the local schools. In theory, they can go to private schools, but in practice, they probably don't have the money to do that. And this is a tough thing because I think the West should be learning a lot from Western industrial policy. One thing we're probably not going to learn and replicate is having a dual class citizenship structure where rural people are just, you know, at the state level discriminated against. Obviously, I'm not advocating that we adopt that. And yet competing against it is really tough. So these people are called floating because they will go sort of following what I would call seasonal demand. But I don't mean autumn and winter. I mean product demand. Right. So iPhones need to be built at insane levels around September, October, November, but not so many are made in March. And so the ability of a Foxconn factory, or what they offer in a sense, is that they will ramp up production by having all sorts of temp workers come in from this rural factory base, right? This rural base of people to work there for 8 weeks, 12 weeks at a time. And then maybe those people move from Shenzhen to Suzhou for the rest of the year or something, or maybe they're working on Panasonic and Sony products rather than Apple products in the same factory. In a sense, from Apple's perspective, who cares? The problem is that the solution is that it's not on their balance sheet. And so Foxconn's ability to like be hyper efficient in allocating those resources can't really be underestimated. And I'm saying Foxconn for the simplicity of the conversation. There are hundreds of factories. That's just the final assembly partner. There's hundreds of factories that rely on that, because the same thing happens at, let's say, Beal Crystal, which works on some of the glass for Apple. The number of people they have working for Apple, according to some documents I have, is 72,000. So that was larger at the time than the 14 factories that Apple had in Vietnam. And so sometimes people do these one-to-one comparisons where they're like, oh, Apple has, like, you know, more factories in Vietnam than 5 years ago or something like that. And it's like, yeah, but what's the labor demand for those factories? Because nobody's on the same scale as China.
So one of my favorite parts of the book, and you're right, it's incredible for 400 pages. It's incredibly readable. It reminded me a lot of Chris Miller's Chip War and just, you know, business and tech. And it reads not quite a novel, but almost. But when you talk about the demand for, I think it was the iPhone 4 around 2010 in China, which I always assumed that you know, a high-end luxury product was you know, made in China, but the market was in the West. And you talk about almost this mafia type groups that were buying them and flipping them. And talk a little bit about that, because it's both, it's relevant, and it creates a little bit of exposure for them politically. But it also, it's not aside from the main story, but holy cow, the demand and the resellers and the yellow cows. Talk a little bit about whether you I don't think you went in with that as part of your story, but you stumbled into it and realized, holy cow, what a story.
Yeah. So this is my favorite part of the book. And one of the reasons it's my favorite is not that it's just that it's thoroughly entertaining. It's also just a place where you get a whole bunch of lessons about China, not sort of academic book lessons, but like the street smarts. But the other reason that I love it so much is that when I wrote the book pitch, it was pretty thorough. It was a 70-page book pitch, but I didn't present this to the publisher or whatever. But I knew that I had a gaping hole, which was that I had nothing interesting to say from the years 2007, when the iPhone went on sale, to late 2012 when Xi Jinping comes into office, okay? So I already knew that the latter thing is the political awakening. It's the catalyst for Apple. I'd already, the catalyst for Apple understanding China. I already had some good sourcing on that. I had a broad sense of what I was going to write. But man, oh man, what a hole it is to not have anything to say about the birth of the iPhone. I mean, it's been covered pretty well. I just thought I was going to have to write some boring narrative about, you know, how they're really made, you know, like vis-a-vis a Nokia or something like that. But every part of the book is like four or five chapters. You know, it's like 60 pages. Like, how are you're not going to have 60 page digression about how the iPhone is made and sort of intricate, like what machines are being used. That would have been terrible. So instead, I found this crazy narrative where, yeah, in 2008, Apple opens its first Apple store in Beijing. They believe it's going to lose money, but they're doing it because the Beijing Olympics is coming up. And the opportunity presented to them is that there's this new mall in Sanlitun. It's not built yet, but Nike's going to be there. Moncler is going to be there. It's going to be like a premium, but not totally luxurious, and certainly not a bargain basement mall. Would you like a two-story location? And so Apple realizes, like, okay, there's a good opportunity here. Let's do it. Not intuitive at all that they should go to China, by the way. I mean, all of their internal projections are that China is, the reason we manufacture our stuff there is that it's a big, poor population. Like, no one's going to be buying this device in major ways. There's not a store yet in Paris, Berlin, or even Hong Kong. So the idea that they should be in Beijing is far from intuitive. It's a success immediately. By 2010, with the iPhone 4, it is wildly successful. Most of you on the call, if you have an iPhone, there's a good chance your first iPhone was the iPhone 4. The number of people that own the first iPhone, I mean, that was 5 million people. The iPhone 3, the iPhone 3G, they're still not that big. The iPhone 4 is when it really goes gangbusters. The chief designer of the iPhone 4 wanted it to feel like it had been licked by 1,000 kittens. Wanted it to look like it had fallen from space. And this is the year, 2010, when Android, for the first time, outsells the iPhone. And Apple's panicking a little bit. And they're being mimicked by Taiwanese brands, certainly by Samsung. There's a lawsuit over this, right? You remember Steve Jobs declared thermonuclear war against Google for Android. And so they're panicking about this. And so for the design of the iPhone 4, the chief designer says, we are going to make it so difficult to make that others will either go broke or go nuts trying to copy us. Well, anyway, when they do build it, it goes on sale 3 months later in China. So it's already successful. But the Chinese just go wild for it. And these gangsters, who in some cases are backed by the Triad networks, okay, so it's sort of the equivalent of the mafia, they recognize this massive supply-demand imbalance. And what's happened is... you know, you've got 1.4 billion people. And at the time, there are four stores in all of China, two in Beijing, two in Shanghai. So one store per 350 million people. I mean, it would be like there's one store on Fifth Avenue, New York, selling Apple products and no other place in America. I mean, imagine the lines. But what's interesting is the lineups aren't filled with sort of what you get like in the West, where you've got Apple fanboys who are just really excited to be the early adopter. It's that these yellow cows recognize this opportunity that, hey, wait a minute, if we get 10,000 of these phones and we go to a city like Chongqing, population 32 million, number of Apple stores zero, we can be basically the monopoly distributor of the world's most iconic product. And so despite the fact that Steve Ballmer in 2007 had laughed at the idea that an American would buy a phone for $500 or $600, The yellow cows are recognizing that they can sell these phones for $1,000 to the top percent of people in a city like Chongqing. The problem is Apple won't sell them 10,000 phones. So what do? You can only buy two phones. So they would bus in 5,000 people, okay, to Sanlitun District in Beijing from all the outside areas. And they would basically have them all buy two phones. And they're just sitting there with Louis Vuitton bags stuffed with cash, giving people the appropriate funds, and the people are coming out sort of like in sequence, you know, at predictable intervals with the new phones. And then they're just getting on, you know, amassing them in these massive quantities and then driving to another city. It's an absolutely wild narrative. And Apple, for a time, loves it, right? I mean, they're basically providing a distribution to the whole country, but at no fee. It's not costing Apple anything. They're throwing elbows in line. They're not allowing ordinary people to experience the store the way Steve Jobs wants. And so there ends up being all these political problems. And it gets worse when the yellow cows get greedy. So I'm fast forwarding the narrative a little bit, and I'll try to simplify this. But essentially what happens is that there's a 20, I think maybe even 22% value added tax in China. So if you're buying these phones, it actually makes more sense. It's more lucrative if you can buy them from Hong Kong or from Portland, where there's no sales tax, Oregon, I should say, and smuggle them into the country. So that's one level of sort of greed. The other level of greed is that some of the yellow cows realize, wait a minute, if we buy these on a 24-month contract at the Oregon T-Mobile store, we can just use a fake ID, acquire the phone for less than $100 on the one paying the one for the first of the 24 months with no obligation to buy for the other 23 months, and then take it into China. Now, the problem with that is the phone doesn't work in China. If you've ever just sort of brought a phone into China, it's a different bandwidth. There's a whole host of reasons why it's not going to work. In the earliest years, there's not even a carrier that will accept it in China. They, using factory connections, they zap the processor. And in doing so, they render the phone inoperable, but they mask the fact that it's been purchased abroad. And they're able to do things like scrub the IMEI number from both the SIM card and the phone itself. And so the Genius Bar is looking at these phones in Beijing and in Shanghai and being like, I don't know why this doesn't work, but this is a brand new phone. I can confirm that. And we must have made a mistake. Here is a brand new sealed in the box iPhone with a new receipt. So in other words, the Apple or the yellow cows are able to acquire phones for less than $100 and then still sell them at $800, $900, $1,000. So they're finding ways to be more lucrative than Apple selling the iPhone across the country. I'll leave it there. This is like four chapters and it's hard to condense it into a narrative, but it's essentially an 8-year narrative of a cat and mouse game with these gangsters outwitting Apple.
Yeah, no, it was a wild story that I had never heard before, and you tell it very well. So back to kind of the main story, you mentioned at the end of 2012, Xi Jinping comes in. Yeah. And I'm interested in talk about how things changed. It sounds like in the very beginning, because of some consumer complaints, because of the reflexive perception of Western exploitation, he presumes that Apple are bad guys, but he seems to come around. How does Apple managed to convince the new very nationalist leader that they should be allowed to continue, let alone to grow and to scale?
A couple different ways to answer this question. So those of you who are China watchers might remember or realize or what have you, that it takes several years to understand that Xi Jinping is sort of China's Putin. And it's because he sort of comes in on a platform, if you will, of going after corruption. And so he's locking up, I think the numbers, I mean, this sounds crazy as I say it, hundreds of thousands of officials across the country within a few years. I remember reading that figure. It was in an Evan Osnos thing for The New Yorker. I think it's called Born Red. Phenomenal profile of Xi Jinping, if anyone's looking for a reading recommendation. And I remember wondering if there was a typo because it said hundreds of thousands of people that he was arresting. And everybody could applaud that. Corruption was a real problem in the Hu Jintao era. Now, what I'm pointing out is that it takes years for people to figure out that he's China's Putin, but arguably the first target, the first opportunity to understand how different she is, was Apple. And it's because within 36 hours of Xi Jinping becoming president, Apple is attacked by CCTV. So that's like state-sponsored CNN. And they're attacked for something that flummoxes them. It doesn't worry them. It flummoxes them. They don't understand that there's a new sheriff in town, as it were. So what they're accused of is having inferior warranty policies to the rest of the world. So the Chinese are somehow being ill-treated by Apple. And Apple basically sees this segment on television and thinks, okay, well, there's really nothing here. Our policies are basically the same. So let's issue a press release, right? And the statement basically matter-of-factly denies the claims and ends by saying some benign statement about how Apple creates unparalleled user experience or something. They are then subject to a three-week, what I call digital blitzkrieg, where bureaucrats, regulators, social media, and other state-backed media just are attacking Apple day in, day out. And the biggest one is when the People's Daily, so think of this as state-sponsored New York Times, puts on their front page, strike down Apple's incomparable arrogance, right? So they're sort of riffing on that line, incomparable user experience? No, incomparable arrogance. So Apple for this time is the poster child of Western companies mistreating Chinese consumers, not respecting them, and so forth. And so Xi Jinping is advocating in China, for China policies. And if you look at public data, it really looks like Apple is an exploitative company. Go back to what I was saying about margins. I mean, the more closely you work with Apple, it's almost an iron law, the less your margins will be. And so the narrative here is that Apple begins to fear that its products could be blacklisted, not an idle fear when Google and Facebook are banned in the country. And so they have to basically determine, like, or first there's a realization, we don't know what we're doing. We don't understand China. We don't understand the culture. We don't understand the politics. How can we get up to speed on this? And so it takes them a few years. And during this time, you know, they're fined by Chinese authorities. They have to pay $80 million. A whole bunch of other things are going on. Qualcomm sets up its first joint venture in the country. Qualcomm is fined $1 billion as a result of this agreement. You know, I talked to people at Qualcomm who said that they were fearful that their executives would be kidnapped. So nobody was going to China anymore. The one negotiator who continued to go would have his meetings in the day and then sleep on the airplane at night. So just crazy things were going on. And Chinese officials were threatening Western companies with antitrust investigations and so forth. And the quote that I take from Reuters is an official saying to 30 different companies, if you complain, we'll double or triple your fines. So this is the climate that Apple is operating in. They're not singled out as the way they are that on that one day. There's a climate of, oh shit, this country's changing and how do we accommodate? And the success of Apple really puts them in a bind here because at this time, China is Apple's second biggest retail market. So this just comes after the narrative I was just telling you about, where Apple's realizing how successful they are. And even more important, of course, than the retail business is that they're the most successful operator in the country. And there's this realization that we can't build the iPhone in the quantities that we're building at anyplace else. And it's not as though they've got like a steady ship at this point and maybe we can diversify. They're growing exponentially. So I forget the exact number of iPhones that are built in 2013. It's probably about 110 million. And by 2015, it's 230 million. So the idea, I'm sympathetic to Tim Cook and team here, the idea that they would just, you know, sort of, you know, make massive investments in Mexico or India or diversify from China, really difficult for them to deal with. I mean, they're just dealing with unprecedented demand for a product that, because of Johnny Ive and his propensity to sort of change direction all the time, is just making things difficult year in, year out. And then all of a sudden they've got this political issue. So it takes a few years, but essentially Apple, for the first time, hires or names, meaning that they transfer existing people over to China. And so this team of eight people, internally they call themselves the Gang of Eight. They look after procurement, retail sales, logistics, Apple University, operations, and so forth. This is the first time that Apple's had senior people living in the country. And they begin to look at, like, how can we sort of make nice with local and federal officials so that they remove obstacles to us being, you know, operating in the country and having a presence here. And I would say the chief thing that they come up with is an argument for why they don't have to do joint ventures, which is what Beijing has been asking Western companies to do for basically since the reform and opening period in 1979, 1980. And so Samsung, I think, has dozens of JVs in the country. And Samsung by 2013 accounts for one out of every five phones being sold in the country. So wildly successful. But Apple doesn't want to go that path. And so what they do is they sort of give a lesson to Beijing, not so different, well, probably quite different, but not so different in theme than what I was telling you 25 minutes ago, which is about the role of the manufacturing design engineers. In May 2016, Tim Cook goes to Zhongnanhai, the citadel of communist power, and basically signs this massive memorandum of understanding after explaining to the top echelons of Chinese officials that, look, it's true we don't have JVs in the country. It's true that as companies work more closely with us, they get less and less margin because we're not paying them big figures. But you have no idea why. And it's because our engineers are sleeping on the factory floor night after night, day after day, week after week, month after month, leading up to a product launch, because we're helping you scale at the quality level that Steve Jobs was absolutely maniacal about. So we are sort of up-arming your entire country and all these industrial clusters to sort of have world-leading electronics. And if you understand Xi Jinping, you understand that in 2015, he came out with Made in China 2025. It was an ambitious plan to sever China's dependence on the West and be self-sufficient in things like robotics and automation and so forth. And so Apple's argument, in my words, it would be very clear that I'm not quoting something here, is that we are the biggest supporter of Made in China 2025. And so when I said earlier that Terry Guo understood something in 1999 that the Chinese didn't understand until 2016, once they have made this explicit, suddenly the message sort of spreads, not in public media, because this doesn't get reported for multiple years, but to the Chinese supply base, that the best way to quote unquote support indigenous innovation is, irony of ironies, to work with the mother of all capitalist companies, because they will train the hell out of you to get everything done. All in there.
Great. Just a couple more questions. So when all said and done, and we're going to skip tons because people will get the book. Did Apple make a mistake in going to China and what they did? It's, you know, to your point, whether you look at Huawei or others, there are now a lot of competitors in country. That are able to leverage the supply chains and the suppliers and a lot of the manufacturing know-how that Apple helped happen and strengthen. Knowing everything, was it a mistake to go? Was it did they make a mistake, or the fact that they've been the most valuable company on the planet for more than a decade suggests they've been just fine?
It's a great question. And of course, I have some answers. I think we're sort of in the time will tell narrative. And I'm also hesitant to give the answer straight up just because I don't want to tell people how to think. I want to give the information. And then I like people bringing their own expertise, their own experience to the table. And I love hearing from readers if they think Apple's stuck, right? So I just want to sort of caveat my answer with that, which is that the book doesn't come from any sort of ideological perspective or what have you. I do say that Apple's captured. And what I mean by that is there's no place else on the planet that combines the same industrial clusters to get you the same cost, quantity, and scale as China has. And if you're going to pull that off at all, it's going to take 10, 15, 20 years. I don't think it can be done, or if it can be done at all. And Apple faces all sorts of challenges in order to make that happen. For instance, the Chinese themselves, you know, they buy $70 billion of Apple products per year. And if Apple becomes the poster child of de-risking because they're accelerating their investments in India, the brand of Apple will change irrevocably in China. So the very thing that I would advocate them doing more in India would cause them problems. And Beijing is, of course, another problem. We can get into that. But to sort of more directly answer your question, I'm sympathetic to all of the decisions that Apple made. I don't think it's a book of making people look like idiots or portraying Tim Cook in some sort of negative light or something like that. It was a whole series of rational decisions. Each one could be understood on its own, but the outcome was sort of that we got outplayed by a long-term nation that had a plan the whole time. So I think in the introduction, I say you had this sense, especially if you were working for Apple, that companies were bending over backwards to win your orders. So the impression you got was that you had the power. And the question that wasn't asked was, wait, why are they bending over backwards to win all of these orders? What are they getting out of it? I mean, Apple would know better than anybody that they're not getting money. So why are they valuing the training so much? And it's something you can only see in hindsight, where China has world-leading industrial clusters of such order of magnitude superiority that experts struggle to even fathom what some of the advantages are and how smoothly they operate. I mean, there's all sorts of anecdotes that I know, and a few are in the book, where China operates at what the engineers call China speed, where things just happen at an inexplicable rate. So I could say, look, when Xi Jinping really went after Apple, that was the opportunity that instead of building up a shareholder dividend and buyback program, they should have been realizing that we need to build resilience in their supply chain, and all the things that they're pretending to do now in terms of investing in India, they should have been doing in 2013, or they just should have never gotten themselves into this problem in the first place. I mean, a company like Dell relies on factory contract manufacturers, but still manufactures itself. And there's been an internal rule at Dell that we will never allow the contract manufacturers to take more than 50% of our work, because we want to retain the value and know-how of being able to do this ourselves. So that arguably was a massive oversight on the part of Apple. And I don't have much hesitancy in saying Tim Cook himself, because as I quoted someone saying once, you know, the buck stops at the guy who ran the supply chain, and Tim Cook is the master of supply chain.
Yeah, and it certainly seems like Tesla has been living a similar, you know, they definitely helped the qualitative and scale of the EV market and makers in China. And now BYD is leveraging a lot of those same supply chains. All right, last question,
okay.
Which is, should the United States government care? Because Apple, you know, Apple followed U.S. policies. They're very much a patriotic company. They're one of the great U.S. champions. The government for a long time was encouraging, you know, global investment, encouraging global trade. Was there a point when the U.S. government should have said, this is not trending the where we want it to? And then what is it that the government might should have done?
Great question. You know, perhaps the subject of a whole other book. A short answer is, of course, the government should care. And I said there's no villains in the narrative. If there is a villain, or if there's an indictment of something, it's shareholder-first capitalism. Because you're totally right. The Western companies were absolutely encouraged to set up operations in China in the early 2000s. I mean, the whole point was that, hey, look at what we've done for West Germany, for Taiwan, for South Korea, for Japan. We've helped these, you know, sort of countries that were all in different shape or form under authoritarian rule for quite a while, and we've turned them into thriving democracies. Now we're going to do it for the world's most populous country. I mean, honestly, there's something noble in that sentiment. I think it turned out to be incorrect, clearly, but I don't condemn people for holding that belief. And it took a while to sort of wake up to the changing reality, which is why it's interesting that Apple sort of had a front row seat from the earliest hours of Xi Jinping's rule. The government absolutely cares. And I suppose my little quip about it, another book there, is that what I'm most interested in these days is what can we learn from Chinese industrial policy? And what can we not learn? Because there's certain things that we're just never going to replicate. Just on a philosophical basis, we would disagree and not advocate for in our own country. And yet, I think it's also worth contending with the many things that China got right, and that Apple should be, or not Apple, that the United States should be learning from. So, look, I do think it's a book of rational decisions, but you know, the bigger and badder that you think China is, the more scary the implications are. And it's been really interesting to hear from people that say, I finished the book last night and it's got me thinking, but man, oh man, am I scared about the future? And I totally understand that. Some people have said this seems to be a book about the betrayal of a company to its own government. I don't say that, but it's not like I'm wondering where people get that from. I totally understand that perspective as well. So look, I love having conversations with people that have read the book because they always bring something different to the table. So it's probably less interesting to hear like what my thoughts are. It's more like, what does someone from the biotech sector think? Because they're sort of in an earlier stage of the sort of Apple narrative. And when they read the book, I'm sort of thinking of a couple people here. They're realizing that maybe the siren call of an emerging superpower, which is how I refer to China in the early 2000s, is a better metaphor than, hey, the prices sure are low. Let's do more stuff in China.
Yeah, it certainly has a slow boiling frog feel to the whole thing to me. I definitely don't see anyone acting in a way that I find unpatriotic or malicious, but it also gets to the conversation that we're having every day and part of what helped bring President Trump to power, which is a recognition that the way globalization was constructed and designed ultimately could get rigged by a player like China, who was going to exploit opportunities and seek its own advantages. And we're now at the point of, okay, now what do we do? So you're right. We're in the lessons learning. The book is Apple in China. Patrick, thank you for spending so much time with us. I've got a few CEOs who ping me, who I'm going to connect you with, who want to ask a question, but I've run out of time. I always promise people we're going to end when we're going to end. You were great. This is fascinating. Congratulations on so much success on the book. I will hold off on hitting you with new book ideas for at least a couple of months, but thanks for spending time with us.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled at the level of turnout. So I hope that was interesting. Sorry for the long-winded answers. I see one person applauding. So thanks, John. appreciate your time, everyone.
Great. Thanks, Patrick.